Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In politics today, there seems to be very little possibility of compromise, and that's not a particularly profound statement. There is a big divide, of course, between the right and the left, but also activists on both sides, activists on the right and the left, often are divided among themselves. Our guest for this hour of the show, Larry Grossberg, he's professor of cultural studies at University of North Carolina. He says that this has been very unproductive, particularly for people on the left. But he has an idea that perhaps the counterculture of the 60s, where people once saw themselves as part of a large movement that was made of smaller movements, might offer a different model. So he'll be sharing some of his thoughts on politics and culture this morning on the program. We're pleased that he is here. He's visiting the campus to give a talk in the Millercom series. That's this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium at Spurlock Museum. These are always open to the public, and anybody who would like to attend is welcome. His hosts here are the Department of Media and Cinema Studies and also the Institute of Communications Research. We're very glad that he could be here. As we talk, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. There's email as well. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. Hey, thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
I'm sure some people will remember the time that you were here. I didn't mention you were here on the faculty for a number of years. You got your PhD here.
Yes.
And I think maybe people will particularly remember you for the course that you taught for many years about rock music.
Yes. 20 years of that I taught here on the faculty, and most of those years I taught a class on the history of rock and roll, cultural history of rock and roll, mm-hmm. which at one point got fairly large and fairly popular.
One of the things that I did to try and get ready to talk to you, I looked at some clips of you that are, now I guess there's almost everybody is on the internet one way or another. And there was a little interview that was on the, that I think your university had put on, and it went back a few years, but you were talking kind of about your work. And you said something that really struck me as kind of funny and maybe kind of telling and maybe has something to say about the academy, and where you were talking about the fact that it got to the point where the course on rock was very popular, and some people here, officials at the university, were not so sure whether it was a good thing to be teaching or not. And you successfully made the argument that was an appropriate subject to teach about. And then you said, they turned around and said, well, okay, maybe it's all right to have a course on that, but you shouldn't be teaching it
yes.
because you love it too much. You,
yes.
you were too enthusiastic about the
right.
subject. And you said, okay, that's swell as long as we tell to all the people who are teaching Shakespeare. It says, well, if you really love Shakespeare, you can't teach this.
Yes.
I liked that little story a lot.
Intellectuals, academics at least, generally, don't deal with passion very well and with strong commitments. Mm-hmm. One is supposed to be dispassionate, objective. I've never particularly been able to do that and never understood why you would want to study something about which you had, for which you had no passions.
So this maybe gives me an opportunity to ask some questions about how does one, particularly if you're an academic, how do you connect what you do as an intellectual with the quote-unquote real world? I mean, you know, how does what happens here in the classroom and people do writing and research and so forth, you know, how does one take that past the gates of the university out into the community?
Well, I think that's a great question, and it's one that I've been struggling with for 40 years as a teacher. I think the path often works the other way around. But we must be careful about that. That is to say, I think the obligation of the academic, and I'll use that because I think not all academics are very intellectual and not all intellectuals are academics. But I think the academic has a responsibility to answer to the demands of the world, that the world poses the questions. Now, I want to immediately say, not in the sense of providing useful knowledge, although some people may, and I don't dispute the value of it, answer quite directly the questions people want to ask. How do I grow better corn, or how do I make government more efficient? I mean that the world, the university is not separate from the world, and that our research interests, in a way, and our teaching interests, it seems to me, are defined, should be defined by the questions that need to be answered in order to make the world into a better place to live for all human beings. I think mm-hmm. that is our responsibility. Now, I think the world doesn't always know what those questions are. It's part of the job of an intellectual to figure out what are the questions that need to be answered and to try collaboratively, I believe, because I think all the interesting questions are too difficult and too big and too messy to answer from within any single discipline or any single paradigm, but to try to begin to figure out the questions and then figure out the answers, or at least present those answers. And I think part of what education is supposed to be is both to teach students to think that way, to think about how to answer the needs of the world and to answer them through critical, intellectual, collaborative work. You know, the pragmatist said all intellectual work is a conversation. I think we need to teach our students how to have a conversation. It is obvious that we have lost much of the ability to have a conversation in this country. People don't seem to understand what a conversation is, because it isn't, I believe X and the hell with the rest of you. Mm-hmm. And I think how one communicates that has become a real issue. And it's become a real issue and problem in part because it is inseparable from a larger crisis of knowledge in the world today. We live in a university that was invented at a particular moment, the kind of university we have in the late 19th century, in order to answer certain needs of society. It organized knowledge in certain ways. It defined knowledge in certain ways. That's all changed, or it's changing. And part of that problem is that the battle, which interestingly enough was of course fought in the early 20th century between faith-based knowledge and secular-based knowledge, was fought. And, you know, William Jennings Bryant, the very famous Scope Monkeys trial, those sorts of things were part of the American popular discussion, and were resolved in certain compromises. They have come up again. Those compromises are no longer available. And I think partly through the actions of academics, the problems have been exacerbated. I don't want to blame the academy for the problems that, in fact, the authority of knowledge itself has been called into question. You know, the climate debates. It seems to be a debate over whether you accept that there can be knowledge about the world. But academics haven't helped in this process. And therefore, it makes it even more difficult to answer your question. How do we communicate what we do outside the university and in the classroom if, in fact, the very principles that constitute what we do, knowledge and education, are now called into question?
Just to talk a little bit more about how it is we get to this point where people have this idea, as you said, they have this idea that conversation is, I believe X, and that heck with you if you don't. You know, clearly if not only if you disagree with you, not only are you simply wrong, but you're also an idiot. You know, there's a lot of that going around. Yeah. I wonder how we get to that point, but I also wonder whether, you know, some people will say, well, the university is actually part of the problem. Being a bastion of liberal thought, does not want to admit to anything outside of that, what's on that end of the political spectrum, so that people say that it's become a place where you actually can't have a conversation if if you don't toe the political line.
And to some extent, I agree with that. To some extent, If you're a left-wing friend, I hope you're still my friend. That is to say, I do believe, you know, that not that there is an absolute truth that academics can discover, but I do believe that there are better stories, better descriptions than others, and not all descriptions are equally useful, appropriate, telling, insightful, etc. I think we, in the attack, which was very important, you know, the early 20th century saw the rise of notions of what we refer to as positivism and scientism, that is, a certain model of knowledge that was absolute and objective. Mm-hmm. Much of the 20th century, especially since after the Second World War, has been spent tearing that model down and saying it doesn't work. And I think that's absolutely vital and crucial. But it doesn't follow from that all knowledge is relative, right? And at the same time, a parallel argument that took place in the, you know, as a result of the 60s, which said knowledge has political implications, became incorrectly, I think, that politics defines knowledge. And I think the left has been as guilty of this as, not all of it, not everyone, but many people have been as guilty as this as the right has. That is, whatever my politics are, I try to do what I do as an academic. The questions I ask may be defined by my politics because, well, what the questions, what the demands of the world are, what would make the world a better place, in my opinion, is a political judgment. So I ask questions. The questions I ask, I think, are defined by that politics. But if my answer is defined by my politics, I'm not doing my politics any good because I'm giving an answer that serves my politics, not an answer that is responsible to the world in a way. You know, you don't get to say this is the way the world is if the world is screaming at you in your face that is more complicated than you want to assume, than your story tells. So I think, you know, part of the problem is that on the one hand, there are too many academics who I don't have the answer to this. I have a problem, who slide from being an academic and an expert to make statements about things about which they are not academics and experts, but they cloth their statements as if the authority of their academic position now carried over into their statement. So I can talk about the financial crisis, right? But if I want to talk as an academic about the financial crisis, and I do, and I did, I had to spend 3 years, you know, as soon as it started, starting to do the research and the reading. I needed to read what economists were saying. I needed to read what sociologists of economics were saying. I needed to get a sense of all the complexity of the arguments about it, the positions, the explanations, the interpretations. I needed to do some empirical work, and I needed then to say, here's my take on it. Let's enter into a conversation. Tell me what you think is good or bad about my position, and I'll tell you what's good or bad. But as an academic, for example, to read Paul Krugman, whom I admire, and then think that you understand the academy, or to read a couple of books of people like, you know, these names may not mean a lot to everyone, but David Harvey, who is a Marxist political economist, or Rick Wolf, another Marxist, to read them on the financial crisis and assume that because you agree with their politics, their analysis must be right, is, it seems to me, to give up everything that makes intellectuals and academics important, which is that we don't do that. Now, I can speak as a citizen, and say, given a choice, I prefer Paul Krugman to whomever, you know, the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan's position, or that's fine. I have that right. But as an academic, I better know that there are actually 7, 8, 9, 10 different accounts besides Krugman's and the Fed's positions on this crisis, all of which have some proponents. And some of them maybe have some truth to them that I need to take up. So, you know, it's a complicated world.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Larry Grossberg. He's a professor in the Department of Communication Studies at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, was for a number of years on the faculty here at University of Illinois in speech communications. He's visiting the campus, talking on the topic, How Can We Sing in a Strange Land in Search of Political Possibility? And that's the title of the talk that he'll be giving on the campus this afternoon at 4. And if you're interested, you can certainly attend. It's a MillerCom event. They're all free and open to the public. And we'd like to invite people into this conversation as well. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Let me just give a little update on the weather here. We're following some severe weather that's moving through our part of the state. And there is, in fact, a tornado watch that will be in effect now until 6 o'clock this evening. There have been several extensions of this watch, so now it's going until 6 tonight. And in our severe coverage area, it includes the counties of Champaign, also Macon, Moultrie, Piatt, Coles, Douglas, and Vermilion. So do keep in mind that the watch, that means that there is a possibility for severe storms in and close to the watch area. So you just want to pay attention to what's going on with weather. Certainly, if there are warnings, we'll bring that to you, and we'll try to keep an eye on the weather, and it's probably a good thing for you to do the same. So again, this is a tornado watch that's in effect until 6 o'clock tonight. Questions, comments, and this part of Focus are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have a couple, and we'll start off with Champaign County in line number one right here. Hello.
Hi, greetings. I had a comment and a question, but not with your what you're just talking about. I would think that you'd be a quick study on the economy, considering I recall that you were involved in bringing Perry Anderson to the campus for, I think it was 8 or 10 major talks through that first unit, our first major unit for criticism and interpretation event. So I would think you'd come to the financial crisis with some of that informed. But I wanted to go to the university as contested place for contested discourse. And just recently a scholar, Stephen Zunas, was on campus for a week. I don't know if he was on the radio, but he was picked as in the top 10 of the Campus Watch malefactors list, I guess you'd call it, and I think they keep a list of 500. So I'm wondering if you made the chart somewhere. So that's just kind of a throwaway on the idea that this is contested territory, and I think it's important to try to open the discourse on the campuses, which are not really bastions of liberalism if you look at where the money's being spent and how much corporate encroachment has happened. But getting to what I haven't heard you speak about, which is your proposal that the counterculture is a model for civic society, I haven't thought of anything about that, but I remember it was conflicted in itself. There were the yuppies and the politicos and new left and older left, and it was fractious time, and even, you know, so I don't know, I guess that's already here in a way. But what I think is emblematic of some of that is, and then you probably treated this in your rock history, which is that, you know, at Woodstock, Peter Townsend, who now is a declared Tory, you know, kept Abby Hoffman from grabbing the mic and trying to politicize the event. And you know, we don't need no politics. We want to rock and roll. So that's a list. I've got to hang up and listen because I got to run. That's why I got in so early today. Thank you.
Well, thank you. You raised a number of points and questions. Let me try to say something about each one. I was part of Carrie Nelson and I, and then later at a second conference, Carrie and Paula Treichler and I, with the help of many wonderful graduate students and support of other faculty, organized some big conferences, one on Marxism and one on what is called, and where my own loyalties lie, if you will, cultural studies. We didn't, I don't remember if Perry gave eight lectures, but Fred Jameson, Gayatri Spivak, a number of people did. They were all what you would call left-wing. Because I listen to people's position. I, by the way, have never agreed with Perry Anderson. But I think he's smart and he's worth listening to and he's worth engaging in conversation, which is what I think the university is supposed to do. You know, although I think of myself as a strong leftist, I think of someone who is in constant conversation with Marxism. There are a variety of forms of Marxism. I don't know that I would call myself either intellectually or politically a Marxist, but I think it's part of the conversation. I agree with you that the conversation should be opened up. I don't know the person you mentioned or the list of 500, but I suppose I should find out if I'm on some list. I agree that the conversation should be open, but as I was trying to suggest, you know, I think people confuse the politics of faculty with the work of faculty. Right? So there, while it's probably true that more faculty on university campuses are liberal or left than conservative or right, it's quite amazing how many faculty are, for example, strong supporters of capitalism. And it's quite amazing how many faculty are, and the history of protests on campuses show this, how many faculty are opposed to what they see as a radical left. And many of those faculty who might still be described as liberals, their work has nothing to do with that. They may be biologists. They may be chemists, astrophysicists. So I think we need to make that clear. And I'm not really, you know, I don't judge faculty by their politics, as I think we shouldn't. You know, conservative has interesting things. I think Francis Fukuyama and William Buckley is bad sentence because Fukuyama's alive and Buckley isn't. Yeah. But they were two people whose work I admire, I find interesting. I never agreed with their politics, but I think it's important work to negotiate with, to be in conversation with, and they're insightful. And finally, the counterculture, and I'll just be brief about this, because you could come hear my lecture. But it is that messiness that I want to capture. I think, you know, as David was saying at the beginning, and for me, this is an intellectual problem because in the book I'm working on now, it talks about the right and the left. It talks about politics and the academy, intellectual life. I think it's ironic that although we on the one hand say we shouldn't think in binary terms because it's very limiting, we always come back to thinking in binary terms. And I want to ask both, you know, it comes back to the notion of a conversation in intellectual life. How do you not organize the world into two camps which are at war with each other? Because I think that's not a productive way, either politically or intellectually, to think about the world. And I think the counterculture was a good example. It failed in so many ways. You know, it's often in the history books written about as if the counterculture were divided into two groups, the hippies who wanted sex, drugs, and rock and roll and that side, and then the SDS politicos who wanted revolution. And I think that's bad history. I think that's the empirical work I've done, partly based on my own experience, but partly based on a lot of reading, is that that's not a good description of the counterculture, and we need to understand it in different terms, and it opens up possibilities.
Let's. We have another caller here.
Yes.
I want to get them in. Somebody on the cell phone. They're in Champaign.
Ooh, sorry about that.
Line two. Hello.
Oh, hi. I'm right in the middle of a rainstorm here. Oh. I was interested to listen to his comment when he was talking about the reading the different economists on the economy.
Yes.
And unfortunately, I'm not going to be in town for, you know, this afternoon. So I'd like to, you know, I'm thinking about the idea of, you know, somebody in academics becoming a subject expert, which I think is a requirement to teach or whatever. And the idea that our society has become so complex that it is difficult to understand all the different little pieces that go together to make sense of something. And so I was interested in the idea, you know, of looking at, you know, anybody's point of view. Each person, I think, is going to have some truth. and it becomes more and more difficult to figure out what is what makes sense. Thank you. I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you. That's great because it gives me a chance to go back to something I started to say. I want to go with you all the way till sort of everybody has a bit of truth. I think part of the academic's job, which we've given up, is to have a conversation which arrives at a more complex picture of the world, and therefore there are different truths that contribute to it, but also makes judgments to say, well, that description is better than that other description, and actually that description you're offering isn't engaging with the world. You just are arguing that because you believe that politics or because you believe that theory. But if you look at the world, I can suggest to you, that something else is going on. But it your question does raise the very important and crucial point about how we do this institutionally. You know, it's become common to talk about the university in crisis. And usually what that means when academics talk about it is, one, our budgets have been cut. And two, they're trying to turn the university into a business. Both of those are true, right? And are serious problems. But I think the crisis of the university is what the gentleman who just called said, in that the world has become more complicated than the organization of the university allows us to deal with. I do not believe you can understand the world on a model of single researchers doing their research or on the model of disciplines who operate within their own disciplinary confines. It has become the buzzword at universities now that we must teach people to think outside the box. The box always refers to disciplines. But I don't think we know how to do that. And if we do, the university isn't organized in a way to allow us to do that, either in our research or our education. So as I said, I had to go and spend 3 years, and I was grateful to have the benefit of some wonderful graduate students who were able to help, and friends, academics, who were able to help me make sense of literatures that were beyond my capacity, to begin to understand research methods that I was not trained in. This is difficult work, and the university has never supported it. So for me, the crisis of the university is, what should the university look like in the 21st century? It probably shouldn't look like what it is, because this was invented in the 19th century, and the world has changed, but I don't know the answer.
We are talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Larry Grossberg. He is a professor of communication studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Was for a long time on the faculty here at University of Illinois. He's visiting. We'll give a talk this afternoon. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe offers specialty coffee and breakfast, featuring a choice of cold and hot breakfast items Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Bevere Cafe is staffed and managed by students. Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. Just a quick mention that Monday, we will have a candidate here. In fact, we'll continue with a series of shows that we're doing with candidates, and we're going to get into now some conversations with candidates for Congress in the March primary here in Illinois. On the Democratic side, there'll be two candidates. On the Republican side, there'll be three. So Monday morning at 10, we'll talk with one of the Republicans. This is in the new 13th Congressional District. Michael Fershing will be the guest. Tuesday, we'll have one of the Democrats, David Gill. That's in the 10 o'clock hour. And also on on Monday in the 11 o'clock hour, the guest is Adam Leshinsky. He's a senior editor at large at Fortune magazine, and we will be talking about a book that he's written that's about Apple, the computer and other company. Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works. That's the title of the book. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. Questions, comments are welcome. You can follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media. You can find us on Facebook, and the website has the schedule there. You can find out what we'll do in the days ahead, and you can also listen to past programs, and that is WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour, we're talking with Larry Grossberg from UNC Chapel Hill. He's visiting the campus hosted by folks in Media, Cinema Studies, Communications Research. We also want to nod toward the Unit for Criticism and Interpretive Theory. He's giving a talk in the MillerCom series, How Can We Sing in a Strange Land in Search of Political Possibility? Anybody's welcome to attend. That's this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium. That's in Spurlock Museum on the campus, and anybody can stop by. Questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I've been doing this for a while, and I've had the chance to talk with a lot of interesting people on a lot of different subjects. And a few years ago, someone said to me, well, what have I learned from doing this? And I didn't have to think very much before I said, well, I'll tell you what I think that I've learned, that almost whatever you're talking about, it's always more complicated than you think. Yes. And that's really what you're saying here this morning. And that to really, no individual is really going to understand some broad thing like the economy, like American politics, you know, like whatever. And now, having said that, though, and hearing what you say about the importance of having this conversation, and particularly within the university, what you do is you bring people together from different disciplines, and you sit down and you talk, and everybody brings their particular insight. Having said that, I think that there, though, are people that will hear this this talk about, you know, hard to have real answers or not the simple answers people want, and will the takeaway for them will be, well, you really don't know. That there is, you can't, it's this desire to have the simple answer. And I think people will be really frustrated when you say, well, there is no simple answer. And then they will say, well, so that means that really, you know, anybody who will talk about giving you the truth with a capital T, you might as well walk away because there is no such thing.
I think you shouldn't walk away. You should engage a person in conversation. And make that capital T truth into a small T truth and open it up. I think it is, you know, the university as we now know it, and people do not talk about this enough in the current moment, the university has transformed our world. Much of the technology, much of the knowledge with which we have created new technologies, biological and mechanical information, much of our understanding of the universe, much of the production of art, etc., has been influenced and shaped through the university system of the United States. And, you know, when Obama came to office and his chief economic advisor, a professor from Harvard, president of Harvard for a while, came up and spoke to the press. He said, the American economy is solid and cannot fail because we have one resource that no one in the world has, and that resource is the American university system. Mm-hmm. Right? And I think that's true. But we now have a system that was designed to solve problems where, in some cases, finding a simple answer as the way in to the solution was a useful tool. I think we now live in a world where, as we can see around us, finding the simple answer, assuming that you know the answer and it's going to follow your own political or theoretical instincts, is no longer productive and useful. And therefore, we have to find ways around that, ways of changing that. Now, you know, your image of just bringing together people to talk, unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. You know, I have a friend at UNC who is a biologist, and he studies octopus arms, which, it turns out, are really quite amazing because they are not articulated. So they have an infinite range of mobility. And the octopus, of course, has 8 of them and can coordinate them individually and with a very tiny brain. So it's very interesting. I mean, this has not only very practical consequences, but it has interesting theoretical consequences. And he has, over the years, put together an interdisciplinary team. Within the sciences, right? So these are bioengineers and geneticists and biochemists and biologists who study anatomy, et cetera, et cetera. And he says it took them years to learn how to hear each other because they each spoke a different language. When I first went to UNC, the provost called me up and said, we're putting together a research grant, some professors, one of these big Rockefeller research grants. And I think they need someone who works on culture in the planning and discussion of this. So would you go and talk to these people who were mainly sociologists and economists and political scientists? And I went, and they were doing research on, they were proposing a research project on democracy and measuring democracy. They have developed, and UNC is apparently well known for this, a quantitative measure of democracy. And when I said to them, well, I don't understand how you could do that, because what the people in Argentina think democracy is might be different from what people in America think democracy is, and what they want might be different. And so how do you take into account the cultural differences around which values and struggles for democracy are organized? And they looked at me as if I was talking Greek. They said, no, no, democracy is defined by these variables. Right? And so happened that year when they did it that Canada happened to be very low on the democracy scale. Right? That is, it isn't just a matter of getting people together from different disciplines or even from different perspectives within disciplines, because we speak a different language as academics. And so we have to learn. That's why interdisciplinarity is hard. Right? Learning, I say this to my provost all the time, who ignores me all the time. You don't teach someone to think outside the box by teaching them to think inside two boxes. Right? You have to teach them how to learn and think across boxes. And I don't think we know how to do that very well. Right? So I think it's a challenge, just as it was a challenge in the 19th century, to get people to focus, right? To become disciplinized. We now, I think, have to face the challenge of not erasing disciplinary expertise, but of getting people to learn how to become interdisciplinized. Mm-hmm. That's an ugly word.
About 15 minutes left in this part of Focus, talking with Larry Grossberg. Just real quick, also let me mention again, we're watching the weather this morning. It'd be a good thing for you to do the same. The Weather Service has issued a tornado watch that will be in effect until 6 tonight for these counties in the area that we particularly concentrate on, Champaign, Vermilion, Piatt, Macon, Moultrie, Coles, and Douglas. We'll try to keep you informed of the weather. You can watch it, too. You can follow it through our website, and we'll go on the air if we have any watches or warnings we need to pass on to you. The guest in this hour of Focus is Larry Grossberg. He's a professor in the Department of Communication Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, here visiting to give a talk here where he got his PhD and taught for many years. Questions, comments, you can join this conversation, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I'm interested in hearing some more about how you think you could approach this problem just within the university of getting people from different disciplines to be able to talk with one another. You just said, well, we really don't know how to do that. Do you have any idea on how even to approach that?
I do have some ideas about how to begin to think about it. Mm-hmm. Right? I did. The question of interdisciplinarity is a major question that every university is confronting. My university, every 5 years, publishes a kind of 5-year plan with five or six goals that they have for the year, for those 5 years. And in the past 20 years, every one of those has listed interdisciplinarity as one of the top 5 goals, and has not made a lot of progress. One of the reasons is because universities are organized by these silos of disciplines. But the other reason is because universities think in terms of permanence. Right? So what they are not very good at is saying, well, a problem may arise, and people are interested in doing the research and perhaps in teaching in it, and students may be interested in it, but it may not continue to be interesting after 10 years. Right? So, at the moment, for example, you could say the question of genetically modified food is a very important question. Right? It's a question that involves a variety of issues of biology. All sorts of biologists would be involved. But it also involves questions of sociology and economics of agriculture, economics of food. It involves questions of ethics. And it involves questions of politics of a variety of different kinds. So getting people together in a group, creating, if you will, a temporary interdisciplinary unit which would have funding through a variety of mechanisms to do research and to do teaching in that area, but then you might be able to say after 5 years, well, we've written a report. We've come to some conclusions, and now various of us want to move on to another problem, right? Because there is the dominant model of the university, of the intellectual in the university, is the model of the expert in a very narrow area who remains an expert in that area forever. One of my close friends is a Shakespeare scholar, and he knows more about Shakespeare than I ever knew one could know. And for him, a radical revolution in his intellectual universe was that he decided after writing about 10 books on Shakespeare's tragedies that he was going to write a book about the comedies. This was a major change for him. Mm-hmm. I admire that. I think those are wonderful. We need those kinds of people around. But there are other models of the intellectual, and that my model, what I like to think I do, is I have a set of skills, empirical research skills, theoretical skills, conversational skills. I have a set of skills which I bring to various problems at various moments as the world says to me, this is interesting. You should look at this. Right? We fund the first one. We organize the first one. We don't have a way because those change. Right? Those interests change over time, and we don't have a way to say, come together, do this work, but you don't have to become a department. My university says to me, of course, you can create a center, but then you have to have some sort of formal existence, and you have to be on the road whereby you start as X, and then in 5 years you become a curriculum, we call it, and then in 5 more years you apply to become a department, and then in 5 more years you apply to have an MA program. And, I think we need to think alternatives. That also means thinking about different ways to educate our students. Again, the university is organized by majors. You have majors. And the university's answer to the problem of thinking outside the box, at least my university's, was to announce the revolutionary policy that you could have 2 majors. You could even, if a student wanted, have 3 majors, or 2 majors and a minor, or 2 majors and 2 minors. Right? Mm. But again, some of us have been saying to the university, but what about a student who doesn't think in that way? What about a student who wants to do some kind of different organization of education? Where's the flexibility? Corporations are all about flexibility these days. Universities are not. That's the irony. So I make lots of enemies when I stand up in public and say, I am not opposed to the corporatization of the university. I'm opposed to the universities becoming Ford Motor Company. That is, as it used to be, I don't know what it is now. But these gigantic bureaucracies that in which change is so slow and difficult, I think we need a different model of organization, and we might be able to learn from some of the corporations. Not that I want to make education into a business or knowledge into a commodity, but I want a better form of organization, and I'm willing to learn from anyone because I want one that is more innovative, more flexible, more creative, more able to respond to changes in the world. So a number of universities are beginning to create what you might call sunshine programs. Organize something, but after 5 years, allow it to disappear and go somewhere else.
Let me take you to a slightly different place.
Yes.
Just because I keep coming back, I guess, to the notion of what happens in the university and how that gets translated to the outside world. And maybe I think about that because I think that what we have always tried to do here is been a kind of a gateway from the one world into the other world. And to go back to your example about bringing people together to talk about genetically modified food, you know, what I think most people, all they really want to know is it okay for me to eat this? Is that an answer I don't mean you personally, but I mean, can an answer to that be found? Can this process come up with the answer that really most people want? The answer to the question most people have is it okay for me to eat this?
Well, having put forward the example, I must now withdraw because I don't know. I don't know in that instance enough about the competing analyses to be able to say, well, we can say, you know, drug companies, although perhaps they lie to us or something, but they can say, well, this drug will produce these effects, it will mollify certain, but it has these side effects. And you have to decide for yourself then, you know, if they're honest. I mean, one hopes that they would be even more honest and say, one in X number have these side effects, and then you can decide for yourself, right? I don't know about that instance, but I'm also believe that very fact that we have created a world and we create our own societies in which people want the easy answer, and they want today the problem is even worse because they don't only want the easy answer. They want the easy answer they already agree with. So, you know, you read Charles Murray and you assume he's right. It's an easy answer and you already agree with him. And if you don't agree with him, you probably don't even bother reading him, right? So I think intellectuals have a responsibility, not just in the academy, teachers, know, to begin to change society and say, we live in a world in which the easy answers don't work anymore. The world is just too complicated. You know, maybe there was a time, although I'm not sure, that, you know, you could get by with easy answers. But you know, this is why our founding figures suggested that for democracy to work, you needed an educated public. An educated public is not a public that says, tell me the right answer. An educated public is one that can evaluate arguments and evidence and say, this is the conclusion I come to. I've read competing visions, and I think this is where my loyalties will go.
I have a question here, and I must apologize because we're coming down to the point where we only have a couple of minutes, but it's come in on email, and I think it's interesting. Maybe you could at least talk about it for a bit. The listener is interested in the Internet and online education. He says, will be a grand experimental test that will change the relevance of the university as we know it, and the adaptation process will not be controlled but will evolve. You have some thoughts on using the Internet as an avenue to do teaching?
The Internet is a tool. You know, my professor here, who has since died, wonderful man named James Carey, wrote an essay called The History of the Future. And what that essay argued, he did it with a student, a friend named John Quirk, and what the essay argued was if you look at the history of technologies, the telegraph, radio, television, every one of those is greeted with two separate receptions. One is, this is going to destroy the world, and the other is, this is going to save the world. People said that about the telegraph. You know, Thoreau thought the telegraph was going to destroy knowledge and education. John Philip Sousa thought the phonograph was going to destroy the family as well as any musical creativity, And other people thought these things were going to democratize it. We forget how much money was invested in public school, by public schools, in the television, because it was thought television was going to revolutionize education. I can remember in public school when the TV came in, and no one knew what to do with it. And, you know, so I think we're seeing the same thing around the internet. Do I think as a tool it is useful? Yes. There are certain subjects that lend themselves to being taught through the internet. On the other hand, not all subjects do, and not all education. I mean, I believe there is a value in face-to-face encounters in trying to teach people how to think. You can give people certain kinds of knowledge over the internet, and that's very useful, and universities should take advantage of it. But if one thinks that this is going to be, you know, teach people how to think critically and intelligently, how to approach the world with a more educated and nuanced way, then I think they're just living in another fantasy by which they think the internet's going to save the world. Will it change universities? Yes, along with many other things, universities will change.
We're going to have to stop.
Yes,
I'm sorry. I would like to keep going, but we're going to have to stop there. And I can just tell people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Larry Grossberg, he'll be giving this talk, How Can We Sing in a Strange Land in Search of Political Possibility? It's a MillerCom event this afternoon, 4 on the campus at the Spurlock Museum at their Knight Auditorium. Anyone who's certainly welcome to attend. Larry Grossberg is a professor in the Department of Communication Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.